Good afternoon. This is Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Our topic today is Title 21, the provisionally approved document that is much in discussion here in Anchorage. You've seen it in headlines. You've seen it in op-ed pieces. But today we're going to focus not on process, but on the substance of Title 21. And we're in a really unique position to do that. We've got great guests. We have Erica McConnell, a municipal planner. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Kathleen.
And we have John Weddleton, who is a small business owner and has been on the Planning and Zoning Commission and was a citizen activist through this process.
Hi, everyone.
So welcome to you both. Really happy to have you here. I think it's a great opportunity for us to peel back the layers on Title 21 and really understand some of the issues. You know, I want to know, why should we care? Who's it going to affect? What's it going to change in Anchorage? And it's a process that's been going on for quite a while. If people don't know that, it's really, there were children who've been born since this process began. So Erica, could you give us just a tiny bit of background of where this began?
Sure. Municipal law is divided into different sections that are address different topics, and those are called titles. And Title 21 is about land use and development, so it deals with zoning. The city's divided into zoning districts, so, you know, what can you do in your zone? Where do you build houses? Where do you build commercial development? Where do you build industrial development? The city's had zoning codes for a long time, decades. The current Title 21 that we work under today was first adopted in the city in 1969, and it's been amended hundreds and hundreds of times. But since we adopted a new comprehensive plan for our city in 2001, one of the ways to implement that comprehensive plan, which was more modern than our previous one, was to rewrite our Title 21, our zoning code, to enable us to bring these more modern concepts to Anchorage, to make our code more flexible, easier to use, and more supportive of the type of development that we see today.
Now, the comp plan was kind of, was that a citizen involvement process? That's my understanding of it, like a giant crowdsourced. What would you love your city to be like? Am I right about that?
You are.
And how long did that take? Do you have that?
I wasn't at the city at that time, but I think it was about a 5 or 6 year process. So during the late 90s, culminating in adoption in 2001.
And then begins the process of, okay, we'll rewrite Title 21 so it matches these aspirations that the community has talked about in the comp plan?
Yes.
Okay. And there's more than one comp plan, right? There's comp plans for Eagle River, but there's a big one for Anchorage. And when people say 2020, they're talking about Anchorage?
The Anchorage 2020 plan applies to the Anchorage Bowl. Chugach Eagle River has its own comprehensive plan, as does Girdwood and the Turnagain Arm. And then there are a lot of other elements that address more specific topics, like the parks plan, the trails plan. That's part of the code.
There's okay.
But things like parks, trails, environmental issues, transportation, stuff
different
like that.
Chunks.
And district plans, hillside district plan, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And there's a downtown district plan, right?
Yes.
So, now, John, what's your involvement been? Since this went on 8 or 10 years, and I know you were on the Planning and Zoning Commission for some of that time, what was your involvement?
Well, I got started as a community council guy, and this came out so early part of the century, and I just looked at hillside issues and some commercial things because I own a small business in a warehouse. Started focusing on that, and it's all a surprise. I think the first time you crack this open, you go, you've got to be kidding. There's all these rules. Who would know? And it just kind of grew from there, where I learned more and more, and then got involved with the Anchorage Citizens Coalition, which had been involved through the writing of the comprehensive plan, and then eventually onto the Planning and Zoning Commission, and continue to track it.
Mm-hmm. So you're sort of steeped in some more things you might not have guessed that you'd be involved in as a citizen. But as a business owner, is that why you got involved?
Well, that's it was more of a compulsion. I can't say it was a whole rational process, but I can look at it from the impact on my business as well as a homeowner.
Right.
And different things. I mean, this is a wonderful city, and as we grow, and we should expect to grow. I think comprehensive plan says we should expect 50 to 80,000 more people, something like that, in the next couple of decades. And how will we handle that? And
where are we going to put them?
Right. And we could wreck the city if we don't prepare for it.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can keep what's really nice about this you know, really, it's a remarkable city to live in. Mm-hmm. Let's keep it that way.
Yeah. And so this is the process by which citizens can somehow influence that and weigh in and sort of set the standards. That's their opportunity, right?
Yes.
So we set out on this program to say we were going to talk about five of the most controversial things. Since this has been sort of a controversial document, although we've been waiting for it a long time, we thought it would be a great way to share the information by taking some of the hot topics. So I met with Erica a while ago, and we sort of talked about what people were asking the most questions about or seemed to need more information about. And that's kind of how we arrived at what we were going to talk about. One of the first ones I wanted to tackle is B3, which is a commercial district, right? And under the new Title 21, it's going to see some changes. Could you help us out with that?
Sure. B3 is the most commonly used commercial zoning district that we have in the Anchorage Bowl today. Now, in our residential zoning districts, we have, 12 or 13 residential zoning districts that have a variety of different intensities. In some zoning districts, you can build, one house on a couple acres of land, but in some, you can build very high-density multifamily development. But with our commercial districts, we don't really have that range of intensities among the districts because we really primarily use this one, the B3. Our comprehensive plan, Anchorage 2020, says to differentiate between the various commercial areas in town. It says to make our major employment centers into more dense, compact, pedestrian-oriented areas that will foster walking, foster transit use, foster the ability to go to, come into this area and park your car and walk around and not have to drive from place to place. So in order to differentiate between Midtown and, say, the commercial area at Jewel Lake and Diamond, just for example, you need to have different zoning districts. And so what we did with the rewrite was we provided three new commercial zoning districts that kind of have different scales. And we called them mixed-use districts, but we don't require mixed-use to be in them, but certainly you're allowed to do mixed-use if that's how you desire to develop. So there's a neighborhood-scale mixed-use district, a community-scale mixed-use district, and a regional-scale mixed-use district. And the idea was that these zoning districts would be applied in our major employment centers and in various kind of commercial hotspots in the comprehensive plan, and then B3 would remain, but would be in other areas of the bowl, things that have more kind of strip commercial development. So some of the changes that we made to the B3 to encourage the intense development into these mixed-use areas was that we added a height limit. There is no limit on height today in the B3 except what the FAA requires for airplanes.
Now, John, you said that height was kind of a hot topic. Why is that? And why did you make that point, Erica, that there's going to be variable height?
Well, height's a big issue. If someone owns property that's zoned B3 and has had plans to build a taller building, then this can look very restrictive. Uh-oh, what am I going to do now? The reality is for virtually all of B3, it's a real limit on height is the parking requirements. You can't go too high because as you go higher, you have more square footage and you have to provide so much parking that you run out of land because of your parking.
I think you made the point that Anchorage doesn't have that many tall buildings because of that, right? We've sort of kept our buildings kind of low because of that.
And you find that the tall buildings that we do have are focused, for the most part, into these major employment areas, Midtown and Downtown, that would be put into different districts with a higher height limit. So for the most part, areas that would remain B3 haven't developed over one or two stories.
Anyway.
Yes.
Anyway. Now, I expect we're going to get a fair amount of traffic, and we do have a caller. I'd like to welcome Diane. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, is there a mechanism to ensure that the boards and commissions who will have to be following the new Title 21 are educated as to the new changes so that they can actually make decisions based on them? And two, will each of the Title 21 changes be coded some way to reflect what policy or goal of the 2020 that they're supposed to be implementing? And I ask this because it would be nice to know whether or not these changes are really implementing the goals of 2020 or whether or not the administration is perhaps inserting individual preferences.
Go ahead.
Hi, Diane. As for your first question, the planning division will definitely be doing a intensive training in the new code for everybody. I'm sure we'll work with the boards and commissions, and we'll work, of course, with the staff in public works and other parts of the city, and with the public and the development community to train them in what the new code says and how to work with it. So that will happen, I'm sure, as soon as it's adopted. In terms of your second question, there is a document online where we took the policies and the strategies of Anchorage 2020 that related to Title 21, and we showed how Title 21 addressed those. We haven't gone the other way in terms of taking each Title 21 provision and trying to show how it relates to a comp plan goal or strategy, but we could certainly try to do that. It just becomes a matter of, resources and time.
Yeah. But I think that that reflects the desire to see the input in the final document from citizens.
Of course.
So, did that answer your question, Diane?
Well, I might chime in.
I have one follow-up on the first question. If there will be education after Title 21 is adopted for the boards and commissions and staff and developers, what kind of education is it going to be for planning and zoning and the assembly when they vote on it in a couple of months, because there will be a whole bunch of new people on the very vital Planning and Zoning Commission, as far as I understand. And when you're new, you don't know what the rules are.
I'd say when I was on the commission, we would get a staff report on any particular project that come up, and it would cite comprehensive plan policies that would be implemented or not through the whatever the petitioner was looking for. And we'd also get, the sections of code that were relevant spelled out for us. So that was always presented to us. And in many cases, even though the kind of old code prevails right now, we would get information on what the new code said. So that education is always there. Now, moving forward, we're expecting the mayor to come forward with some changes in the provisionally adopted chapters. And it would be good for each of those changes to be addressed separately and justified in terms of what comprehensive plan policies are implemented or improved on by those changes that are proposed. So I would like to see that, and we'll just have to wait and see if it comes out that way.
Okay. Diane?
Thanks.
You're welcome. By the way, I realize I didn't put out the phone numbers. So let's let people call in. It's 550-8433 if you're in Anchorage. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, it's 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. We're live today from 2 to 3, and you have the opportunity to ask your questions right now to these two folks in the studio, Erica McConnell and John Weddleton. Tonight we'll rebroadcast this at 7, so you can also listen again, but no chance to get your questions answered. We also have some good documents on the alaskapublic.org website. We borrowed from the Muni heavily Title 21 rewrite, the analysis that compares the rewrite to the provisionally adopted rewrite to Comp Plan 22 to Diane's question. There's a bunch of things there that's very useful for you. So I encourage people to go to the Muni.org or alaskapublic.org. So anyway, we were just in the middle of talking about B3 and the various ways, the various densities that are going to be allowed in the rewrite to kind of fit the various personalities of town, like the big employment centers. I guess we're talking, let's name them so people can get a picture in their head of what we're talking about. What are the big, what ranks as an employment center here?
We have three major employment centers in the Anchorage Bowl, and they are downtown, midtown, and the UMed district.
Okay. And are you actually saying you want to have houses near there so people can walk to work? Is that part of the plan?
Definitely. One of the main thrusts of Anchorage 2020 is to provide people with more choices. So people who would like to live closer to where they work, who maybe don't want to drive their car every day, perhaps they'd prefer to walk or take the bus or ride their bike to work, they should be able to find housing in areas that are near where the jobs are. And mm-hmm. So, yes, we are encouraging more residential development in downtown and midtown in the UMed area.
And where is that going to go? Is that infill kind of thing? Like we've had, We haven't been that dense in some of these areas, even though there are big employment centers. So you're looking at that leftover space and trying to affect the density there?
Leftover space, the few vacant areas that still exist. There are certainly properties that are, you know, outliving their useful life and that will be redeveloped over time, mm-hmm. Especially as property values increase as they do over time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now, John, would you be considered in Midtown, your small business? Or were you really?
Well, we're in Spinard.
Spinard, yeah. Which is not in its own district, uh-huh. Even though maybe it should be, right?
Well, a lot of us think of it as our own little area. But, another aspect on the mixed use is also bringing small commercial towards the neighborhood so that you have maybe a small store like the New Sagaya within walking distance of your house. And there's provisions that make that acceptable to people. Because if you want to really pack an assembly meeting, talk about putting some business in your neighborhood. And mm-hmm. people get really fired up over that.
They're afraid of it.
But there's a lot of benefits too. And done well, it's really a great thing for a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the new code kind of outlines some parameters for ways that can be done so that it's done acceptably and in a good way.
Well, so if someone's afraid of that, what's your answer, Erica? How do you quell their concern?
I think one of the biggest ways to quell their concerns is to have design standards, you know, so they know what's the building going to look like, how is the lighting going to be addressed, what are the buffers going to be between that development and what's around it, what are the hours of operation going to be? That can be very important.
What kind of lighting are they going to have?
Exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And, of course, now the small business owner, would they have concerns about this, or they're just anxious to get into that neighborhood? What do you think about small business?
Well, if you put a small business in the middle of a neighborhood, you have potential for a lot of complaints from neighbors if you're too noisy, too much traffic, and so on. So you'd want to have it done right in a way that's acceptable.
And are there design standards how do they fit into a neighborhood? You know, are there design standards that help them fit into a neighborhood?
Sure. I mean, things like we just talked about lighting standards, buffers, trying to make the development accessible to pedestrians so that it isn't that everyone has to drive to that business,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
that it's welcoming to people who are walking from the neighborhood itself to help make it a part of the neighborhood, mm-hmm. instead of something that is separate and disliked.
Okay. Go ahead, John.
Height restrictions are big there, too. We have a few cases where there's a commercial building right up against residences where the commercial building dwarfs an apartment building or homes. And when people see that, that's what they're thinking when they think commercial in the neighborhood. And that's really a disaster for the neighborhood.
Right. It changes the nature and the character of the neighborhood, which is what people don't want to see happen. Mm-hmm. But you're saying in Title 21, you feel you've got accommodations so that it fits in.
Yes.
I want to go to the phones just because I want to make sure we get as many people who have questions for you on. Gordon, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you for the opportunity. My question was, Anchorage has a fairly high injury rate, and how will Title 21 make the community safer in terms of injuries?
Injuries. Okay. Erica, what do you think?
Well, Title 21 mostly addresses development on lots, so we're not focused on roadways, but in terms of on-lot development, we do have provisions that strengthen the pedestrian environment, so providing pedestrian walkways from the street to the primary entrance of the development or from a bus stop to the primary entrance of the development. So attempts to have the pedestrian flow on a lot have less conflict with cars, and so that'll prevent injuries in parking lots, or at least help to reduce injuries in parking lots.
Okay. How about that, Gordon? Any other aspects of that question?
Well, I think, the development in terms of keeping cars and bicycles and pedestrians separate, when we look at motor vehicles as being one of the leading causes of injuries in Alaska, the second being, and the first one being falls, I think it would have a great impact.
Well, now, what are we saying about bicycle paths in Title 21? Go ahead.
There's a new bicycle plan. It was adopted in the last year or two that talks about a bicycle network throughout the city, which, again, is more in the right-of-ways, so not directly addressed by Title 21. But we are requiring a little bit of bicycle parking to be provided new developments to encourage and help people to ride, you know, when they do ride their bikes, that they have a safe place to put it while they, you know, shop or work or whatever at their destination. I think also that, you know, it's kind of at the macro level, but by allowing people to have more choices in where they live and thus use non-vehicle transportation more often, that is helping safety, because there are studies in other cities that show that when you actually increase bicycle and pedestrian traffic, the accident rate goes down because everybody becomes more aware of the bicycles and the pedestrians that are also using our right-of-ways.
John, chime in.
In case anyone gets worried by that term bicycle parking, which sounds pretty, lofty, basically that means if you have like an apartment building with four or five apartments in it, you have to have a bike rack for about four bikes. So that's what bicycle parking is.
Versus car parking.
Not much.
Versus
right.
car parking, which is quite a bit different. Right.
Right.
Yeah. So, Gordon, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it's a good start. I don't want to underplay it, but I mean, Anchorage is going to expand. There's only so much you can expand in terms of roadways. So we have to use the roadways that we have more efficiency to move more people. And that involves like buses and bikes and walking. And many of the reasons why people drive just a few blocks is because it isn't easy to walk or bike in this community. And I think, at least how I look at Title 21, by making the walkways more accessible and bikeways and parking available, that it makes it more user-friendly for pedestrians and bicyclists, so we have fewer cars, and so our roads aren't choked. So even people who are driving will have an easier time because there'll be fewer cars there.
Yeah, I am thinking of a story I read in the Anchorage Daily News years ago about people who would take the bus, and they called them the berm people because they would perch on the berm, the snow berm. I mean, it's really gotten a lot better in Anchorage in the last couple of years. I mean, those nice bike bus stops and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, organizing your workplace in, so that the transportation can bring people to work and they don't have to bring a car. I mean, it's a hard retrofit. It's better to do it at this stage, maybe.
And it's,
I guess there's one final part in here. You know, we're adults. We think about we have the option. I have a car. I have a bike, et cetera. But, you know, young people who are young people who don't have access to cars, you know, if they even want to go to after-school activities, et cetera, basically need to have someone ride them because it's not a safe way to walk. And I would also say the people who are elderly and can no longer drive or no longer should be driving. You know, so there's certain populations where this is really a vital concern that we need to look at as a community.
We have a growing population of aging people. I think it's one of the fastest age groups.
I seem to be getting there rapidly, and I'll use that last comment to go off air. And thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thank you, Gordon.
Gordon, you reminded me of two things. One is that and I kind of contradict myself, that we actually are addressing the issue of providing more sidewalks, that new roads will have sidewalks, or in the provisionally adopted code will have sidewalks on both sides of the street to make sure that there is a safer pedestrian environment for, I remember hearing someone say, well, if you build a pedestrian environment to accommodate 8 to 80, 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds, then you've pretty much handled everybody in between. Mm-hmm. The other issue is another reason to build up our major employment areas, our intensity in Midtown and Downtown, is that it takes that intensity of development to help facilitate our bus system, that there has to be enough people that are going to one area in order to have a strong transit system. So allowing that sort of transportation choice is very important for a reason for building up our putting a lot of our employment into Midtown, Downtown, and the UMed area.
You know, Gordon mentioned being able to walk in little trail segments and so on, and I've got a friend of my son's who lives a quarter mile away from his elementary school, but because of no simple pathway across two lots, he has to drive 2 miles to get to school, and
Ouch.
it's ridiculous. And we see that all through Anchorage. But the new code, I think it's in the subdivision section, would require that there be trail connections between the ends of cul-de-sacs and between various subdivisions. And these trail connections are like 10 feet wide. It's not a huge burden for anyone, but a huge benefit for the city as we as we grow.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about the interconnectivity index, and that makes me think about it. But Is that, can we talk about that a little bit? What is it? I know it's better described if you can look at it, but what's the motive behind the interconnectivity index?
Well, connectivity means having multiple choices for getting in, out, and through an area. So I think your area with the most connectivity is a grid system, something like downtown or South Addition. And we're certainly not saying that everything has to be a grid system. What we've done is require what's called a connectivity index. And this is where it gets complicated. And it basically says there has to be a certain ratio of intersections to links between intersections. And so that is saying you have to have a certain number of ways to get out of a development area like a subdivision and a certain number of connections within that subdivision. But by doing it through an index, we're really giving the developer the flexibility to design their subdivision however they want as long as they meet this index. So we're not trying to tell them where the streets have to go. And the reason this is important is that the more paths you have for traffic, the less impact you have on any one street, any one intersection. So if you think about it, if you have kind of a spine road and you have, you know, six cul-de-sacs coming off that spine road, everybody who lives on those cul-de-sacs has to get onto the spine road in order to get out of their neighborhood, yeah. which puts a lot of traffic impact on that spine road, on the next intersection at the end of the spine road. But if you have more ways in and out of the neighborhood, the burden of the traffic isn't at any one particular location.
Right.
And
I can,
that's better for everybody.
That's happened in my neighborhood. I'm in an old neighborhood. It's like Spinard-Turnagain area. But there's one street everybody goes out and they make a left turn on and they're freaked out, you know, and the line backs up because Northern Lights is pretty fast. And everybody sort of learned to go other ways, which is really nice. It takes the burden off that kind of scary left turn that a lot of people have to make. So that's what the interconnectivity index is all about.
And of course, there's, you know, provisions for if you're doing infill in an area and you just really can't make those connections because of the pattern of surrounding development. I mean, you don't then have to do it. So there's flexibility and a kind of a relief valve within the code.
Right, right.
You know, the first time you're flipping through the code and you run into this, you're taken aback by it. What is this connectivity index? But it's actually not very complicated. You put a little dot on the roads and a little star on the intersections, and you divide one by the other and see where you land. So it's fairly simple, but it is designed to give developers flexibility in how they do it.
That's good. That's good. I mean, that, one of the things Erica mentioned to me was incentives for builders so that they had choices, ways of approaching solving a problem, less prescriptive.
One thing we've tried to do in the design standards, and maybe this is a, I don't know
Segway.
If you want to turn to this
Segway.
Now, but
yeah.
We tried to use menus. So a menu would address a topic like the relationship of a building to the street, but we wouldn't say to the developer, you have to do X, Y, and Z. We would say, you have choices A to, you know, H, and, you know, I don't know, 9 or 10 choices, and you have to do 3 or 4 of them. And that allows the developer to select from the menu what works best for that particular site, whatever the uses that are being developed on the site and that sort of thing. So we've tried to work that. I mean, there are definitely some things in the code that are prescriptive, but where we could, we tried to put in a lot of flexibility.
All right. Well, we're talking about Title 21. We have Erica McConnell, a municipal planner, and John Weddleton with me. And we'll be back in the second half hour. We're going to talk about snout garages. We're going to talk about cost. We're going to talk about a lot of things. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska.
Listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage. Thank you.
Hi, this is Kathleen McCoy. You're back on Hometown Alaska. We're talking about Title 21, which has been in the headlines and in the op-ed columns. But our emphasis today is really talking about what's in the code, what will it do for Anchorage, how will it change Anchorage, are we going to like it, and who's it going to affect, and how is it going to affect them. In the studio with me, I have Erica McConnell, who's a municipal planner who worked a number of years on this, recently moved into transportation, but did a bulk of your work at the city in on this. And we have John Weddleton, who's a small business owner and served a term on the Planning and Zoning Commission, and through just can't help himself, and he keeps following planning in the city. So welcome to you both again. And I'd like to invite our callers to ask these two people great questions about Title 21. You can call 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 or send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'm going to turn to a few emails because we have gotten them and we haven't really had a chance to deal with them. Wendy Beach writes that she's noticed that in some other states, and it's kind of interesting to see how does Alaska and Anchorage compare to some other places. She's noticed that they've had to build cities close to work because there's big employment centers and no place to live. And this gets to your point about the employment centers, I guess. You know, if we're moving towards these big hubs, why not do it now? Why not, as opposed, and so other cities are doing this, other communities are doing this.
I think as energy costs go up, you know, gas prices rise, you know, they always rise a lot and then they fall a little bit, but they never really get back to that original level. Transportation. So, you know, that affects transportation costs. And I think people are moving towards being interested in not spending so much of their time and money in a commute, but having more family time and just having a closer distance between them and their workplace so that they don't have to spend as much time and money. And that speaks to allowing people the choice of living closer to where they work, which is a goal. And again, it's not for everybody. Some people are always going to, you know, want to have a large lot in a more rural environment, and that's great. It's trying to accommodate a whole wide variety of things for different people.
A broader choice.
Exactly.
Now, we were talking about mixed use, and we did talk about the sort of little grocery store on the neighborhood corner or somewhere within a neighborhood so you could walk to it, or a coffee shop or whatever services you want. But there's also several other levels there, and I know that the plan calls for town centers but also sort of regional commercial centers.
Mm-hmm.
So are these B3 changes accommodating those?
Well, again, the B3 changes are going to be, I mean, the way it's envisioned through the comprehensive plan and the draft land use plan map is that B3 would stay in your kind of strip corridor. So think of like the old Seward Highway.
Okay.
That's a perfect example. But besides the three major employment centers, which we discussed earlier, some of the other kind of regional areas are the Diamond area, where you have the anchor of the Diamond Mall and the development around there, and our new Tikatnu Center up at Muldoon and the Glen Highway. And so those are some regional areas that might, and again, I these things aren't necessarily adopted, so I can't say that what will happen there, mm-hmm. but those might end up being areas where, you know, we might encourage a regional mixed use zoning district. And I also want to point out that, you know, the plan for implementation is to incentivize moving towards new zoning districts that are provided in the new code. You know, we'll offer the option to the developer and hopefully those property owners who are in these kind of comp plan specific areas like the major employment centers will show them how a mixed use district would work better for them. And perhaps, and these details aren't worked out, but perhaps incentivize a rezoning by maybe waiving the fee, something like that, so that they could move into compliance with a land use plan map, whatever that looks like when it's adopted. And that's you could do a whole nother show on the land use plan map, but try to help them achieve compliance with municipal plans and policies rather than impose it upon them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we already see people, developers, and so on, moving towards taking advantage of these town centers. I pass through the Abbott Loop Town Center area frequently, And we see a lot of good variety of commercial right in the core there, but also the Lumen Design, I'm not sure what the company is building right next to Spring Hill and Hanshu, a mixed use. They have like apartment building that'll be for seniors. There'll be houses behind there. And the convenience there is they can walk right across the street and be at Fred Meyer's. There's doctors right in that easily within walking distance. Mm-hmm. Another development on O'Malley and Lake Otis was rezoned so they could get higher density to take advantage of the fact that they're within walking distance of this town center. So even without this code in there, people are heading that way.
Because of the way people are living or the way our community is shaping up. They have these needs.
Mm-hmm. You know? They have a market for it.
We've got callers, so let's go. And Joan, you're on Hometown Alaska.
My question has to do with, they just said that the Comprehensive Plan 2020 was passed in 2001 and provisionally accepted. Why is it taking 10 years for it to be implemented, passed and implemented?
It's a question for Erica.
Sure, and Joan, that's a good question.
It's a decade that people have been working on this and hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on contracts and consultants and
I think it speaks to the level of interest in our community. And while it's both, you know, it's frustrating that it's taken so long, of course, it's also exciting because it means that people are paying attention, people are getting involved, people are talking about the issues. And, you know, I think when the project first started in 2002, we certainly didn't anticipate that it would take this long. You know, we thought it was going to be maybe a four-year project. But again, like I said, the level of interest, the complexity of the issues, and I think the fact that, you know, our current code is 40 years old. So we were really digging into the changes, and I don't think we've made radical changes. I think we've really brought it up to more modern standards.
A lot has changed in 40 years. It does take time.
Yeah.
yeah. Go ahead, John.
You know, Joan, you're right. It has taken a long time, and it makes you want to scream sometimes. But, you know, it is important to get it right. There is a problem, though, with taking so long, is now we've got this, we're kind of in limbo because we have what is truly the legal zoning laws, which is the old laws, and then the new laws that we're writing on, they're working on, and they're provisionally adopted. And developers are really forced to keep their eye on both of those. The old laws don't necessarily implement the comprehensive plan. So I know in my time on the Planning and Zoning Commission, we'd often have contradictory situations where following the existing land use laws goes against the comprehensive plan. So it is really important to get this done. And there'll always be improvements to be made, and that can be done one amendment at a time like we've been doing for decades.
Thanks, Joan.
Okay. Thank you.
Helen, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
My question is about the forthcoming public process and the availability of the information, the rewrite, an analysis, perhaps, or something that highlights the changes, so are those things available or going to be available soon? What's the schedule for that? And then what will the public process of review of that be?
Currently, the mayor is... So the way it works is that this is an ordinance that's coming from the planning department, which is part of the administration. And so the mayor puts forward this ordinance to the assembly. And so at the moment, he's involved in a review to make sure that he's comfortable with what the ordinance says, and he may have some amendments that he wants to request. And when he's finished that review and has those amendments ready, the document will be released to the public. And my understanding is that will be sometime in the next month, sometime in September. The public will have an opportunity to review, and then it will go to the Planning and Zoning Commission for their recommendations. My understanding is that the assembly, which has a committee that works on Title 21, so the Assembly Title 21 Committee will also review the document, and then when that process is finished, it will go to the full Assembly. So there are three formal opportunities for public involvement: hearings at the Planning Commission, meetings of the Assembly Title 21 Committee, and the full Assembly meeting. But you know, within that process, there's also opportunity for people to send in written comments or contact their Assembly person directly.
But we don't know what the changes are, so how can we comment?
When this is after they're released, so, you know, in the next month when the mayor releases his recommendations, it will be clear in that document what the changes are that the mayor is proposing from the provisionally adopted document. Those changes, you will be able to tell what is different.
So the website says the tentative date for the first public hearing is October 3rd. If this doesn't come out till the end of September,
then that date will be pushed. If it doesn't come out till the end of September, that date will be pushed back.
So do we guarantee 2, 3, 4 weeks of opportunity for the public to figure out what the changes are and prepare?
There's a code-required public notice period of 21 days. So that's a minimum, and it could be more than that.
Okay, so we'll have at least 3 weeks to understand what these are.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Helen.
Bye.
3 weeks isn't much time to read 600-something pages of code, trust me. It's surprising that the mayor's had 2 years to go through it and the citizens get 3 weeks. And what this really should look like to you is that we are about to get a rewrite of the rewrite before the rewrite's even adopted. And the way it looks to me is that the Assembly is really not kept up with their job. They had them provisionally adopted. The ball is in their court. And that's something they should adopt these. And then the mayor comes forward with amendments to it. So it seems out of order for me to see that the mayor is basically rewriting something that was rewritten and not fully adopted yet. It's just an odd situation.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be an interesting month, September. And October, too, probably. Phil, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if there were going to be changes in the building safety code boundary as a result of changes to Title 21.
Do you mean the building safety service area?
Isn't there a boundary? If you're within it, you need a building permit to build, and if you're without it, outside of it, all you need is a land use permit.
That is correct. And no, there are no changes to the boundaries of that area in the code.
Okay. Oh, great. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Just want to let our callers know if they've got questions for Erica McConnell, a planner from the municipality, or John Weddleton, a business owner and planning and zoning commissioner at one time and just an interested citizen, please give us a call at 550-8433 or send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. I have a couple more emails, so I'm going to go ahead and address these questions to you guys. Jeff is writing from Midtown, and he says, I'm sorry, I don't understand all of Title 21. Who does, right? But he wants to know, will mobile homes be banned or disallowed from future development?
No, they will not. We recognize that, you know, mobile homes are a established form of housing in our community, usually a form of affordable housing, and they will certainly not be banned. Our current regulations allow mobile homes on individual lots in certain zoning districts, and they allow mobile home parks in certain zoning districts, and those regulations have not changed in the provisionally adopted draft.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to get to cost. We were trying to get through five controversial aspects of Title 21. We've been through like maybe two of them. So let's tackle cost. Just what's, you know, people might be afraid this is going to cost us an arm and a leg. What do the planners' answers there?
Cost, it's certainly a very valid concern when you're changing development regulations, when you're trying to, you know, raise the bar on certain types of development. And we've heard a lot right from the beginning of the project about how much is this going to cost, and we have to make sure that we're not, you know, putting a burden on development and slowing economic growth. So when the public hearing draft was released, the planning department contracted with a firm out of St. Louis, Missouri to examine the how the at the time it was the public hearing draft, how the public hearing draft would impact the value of land and also how it would impact the costs of development. And the general conclusions from that analysis was that the public hearing draft would have a neutral impact on property values, except for certain industrially zoned properties. And the reason for that is today, in industrial zone properties, we have the I-2 and the I-1. You can pretty much do any most commercial uses in those properties as well as industrial uses. And Anchorage 2020 tells us or directs us through policy to reserve key industrial areas, and it identifies certain industrial reserves, although it isn't saying just those reserves, but the reserves and key industrial areas, reserve them for industrial needs. And so that was back, you know, in 2001 when that was adopted. And then there was a Anchorage Industrial Lands Assessment that was prepared and released in 2009 that said, you know, we don't have as much industrial land as we used to. And, you know, there are a lot of developments that have been done, commercial developments that have been done on industrial zone land. So we need to protect the industrial land that we have left for industrial needs. So the allowance to do a lot of commercial uses has been removed from industrial lands.
Can I? When you and I talked about this, you gave me a good example. Target is out there in the middle of what seems like industrial property. That's an example of a commercial business going in an industrial area, and you know that's something that Title or Comp Plan 2020 is asking not to have happen.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a couple of different other, like the Home Depot and the cars that are in Abbott are on industrial lands. Now, those established, you know, those areas where there's established commercial uses on industrial land would probably end up having incentivized rezones. So we wouldn't be creating nonconformities in those areas. But in certain easily accessible industrial lands that are now more restricted in their use, the land value of those properties could end up falling, and our analysis said by maybe as much as 20%. And again, this is not an across-the-board drop in value, but for certain key accessible areas. But in the future, you know, when industrial land continues to be at a shortage, the values may rise again just because supply and demand, that you would have, you know, not very much industrial land left for the industrial needs that we could have in the future.
Now, we've got a lot of calls coming in, but John, you wanted to weigh in.
Well, I'll just throw in some. That location of the Target on 100th and King Street is kind of highlights some of the problems with allowing commercial and industrial areas. And one thing it does, it breaks up kind of a continuous tract of open land, which a lot of, if we build a pipeline and we need big open spaces to store pipe and so on, well, this breaks up what could be used as continuous area. But it doesn't only affect the specific land that it's on, but the surrounding land can be affected by it too. When I was on the commission, they tried to rezone to B3, and a lot of reasons why that could happen there. But what that does is it affects the industrial land around it, would then have to meet more strict noise requirements and dust requirements and so on. So it wouldn't just be the acreage the Target is on, but all the surrounding industrial land would be
effect.
More restricted.
Yeah.
So it is really important to keep the commercial off of those industrial.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to the phones because, you know, we're ticking down here and I want to make sure people get to answer the questions. We've got Assemblyman Harriet Drummond. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, everybody. I am Harriet Drummond. I represent West Anchorage, and I have been on the Assembly's Title 21 Committee since I was elected to the Assembly in 2008. And I too am very frustrated at this process. I just want to tell you the good news is that Chair of the Assembly and also Chair of the Title 21 Committee, Debbie Osiander, is setting the first meeting date for the Assembly Title 21 Committee, and that looks like it's going to be September 22nd. 10 to noon in the usual place in the Public Works building. As you know, Erica, where we've spent many months.
Yes.
And also, you just mentioned the target on 100th Avenue. There was a resolution introduced last night at the assembly meeting that will be up for public hearing on the 13th of September at our next meeting regarding some leftover obligations from that development. And there were some questions by assembly members raised by email prior to the meeting about how Target has developed that land and what the Planning and Zoning Commission actually required of them before they did that. So that's all I have to say. I really have to say, and I want to make room for other callers, so I'll listen offline unless you have questions for me.
I got a question for you.
You bet.
So if this won't go to the Planning and Zoning Commission until October, and the Planning and Zoning Commission is advisory to the Assembly, what would your committee discuss prior to the Planning Commission getting it?
Well, my hope is that what we are going to see is the draft that you all have been discussing for the last 45 minutes with the proposed changes from the contractor's work over the past year. And I, for one, plan to bring the provisionally adopted sections and begin the comparison right there.
Thank you, Harriet.
You're very welcome.
All right. Bob, hi, you're on Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Well, it was similar to what Mr. Drummond was talking about, where are we going to be able to see the plan as it was originally envisioned and then Coffey's version? Are we going to be able to see what was changed? When I got a document on a computer and I'm reviewing it, I can, you know, cross out certain and insert, and it's all visible what I crossed out, and it's all visible what I would like to insert. Or are we going to have to go through 600 pages with a book side by side?
The recommendations that come from the mayor, it will be very clear what changes he is proposing from the provisionally adopted draft.
So we'll be able to go side by side and see the differences? Or within the document?
Yeah, are they going to be, you know, like this is crossed out and this is added, or he's just going to say this is what we're deleting and add this, delete that, add that? That's what I'm wondering about. But nobody's seen this document to know, right?
I'm not sure of the precise format. I know that there will be a way to distinguish what the changes are, but I'm not sure of the precise format of the document at this time.
Well, if our assemblywoman was listening, I hope she would encourage that the document be provided, the changes be right there with what was deleted and what was added and what was changed, so we don't have to go through 1,200 pages when they could be, you know, in one document with the changes right there along with it. I mean, with the computer, there's no reason, but, you know, we've seen what our governor did with the, he had it put out in paper copy and not available online. So I hope that this will be available online and they don't do the, Sullivan doesn't do what Parnell did. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you for your call. And Stephen, we were talking cost and you have a cost question?
I do. And before that, I want to join the chorus of people that are complaining about the fact that we had a former assemblyman who sat down and made agreements with other assembly people and then was hired by the mayor and almost laughingly say he's going through and crossing out what the other people wanted in that public process. My question, though, is there was inference here earlier in the program that good planning costs us money. And actually, if you look at any of the great cities in our nation, there's a lot of good planning that went behind that. And there's good economy for cities who were successful in good planning. Even though there are restrictions on development, it pays in the value later on. Is that not true? I'll take the answer off here.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Thanks, Stephen. I think that's true, but I think it's a lot harder to quantify the benefits, and that's why we end up focusing on the hard costs that are raised. Oh, I now have to provide two trees instead of one tree. Well, that costs me, you know, twice as much. That's easy to put down on paper, but the benefits to, you know, just using the landscaping example, the benefits to cleaner air, to the buffer from the neighbor, to the aesthetic enjoyment of the people who are using the area, that's really hard to put down in dollar figures. So we don't end up accounting for that In our documents.
It kind of makes me think of the Coastal Trail. I remember when it was going through, people were very concerned about it, and now it's sort of people, when they're selling their house, they'll say only a block from the Coastal Trail. So, you know, before you see it, maybe you don't exactly know the value is what you're saying.
But I would also hark back to a point I was trying to make earlier that, you know, when you do have other transportation options, you do have the ability to live closer to work, you know, you can quantify the hard costs of your energy costs, your transportation costs.
Your gas costs.
Yeah, so some things can be put onto paper. But again, we don't know who's going to take advantage of, you know, deciding they're going to move from, you know, suburb X into Midtown because they decided they want to live closer to work. So again, we can't really put that into our analysis. But, you know, people who are able to take advantage of more choices will, you know, could save money.
It's kind of a look at the long term versus the short term. And maybe our state is one that is fixated on the short term a little bit, although the longer we stay, the more it matters that we do it right. So just one last shot at our two guests here. If you'd like to call 550-8433 or shoot us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'm with Erica McConnell, a municipal planner, and John Weddleton. We've been talking about Title 21, which has really been in the news and is going to be in the news. And this is your chance to ask questions about what's in this provisionally approved code. Let's see. So we were dealing with cost. Have we finished with that? Did you have anything to add there, John?
Well, I might throw in something there. Addresses what Stephen said, but you know, we can look and see the cost of you know, adding a little trail connection and making the place a little bit nicer for walkers and bikers and so on. But you know, if you're building commercial property, a huge part of the cost is providing parking for cars. And with I have a little retail store now, and for every 300 square feet of retail space, I have to provide 400 square feet of asphalt to park cars. And that is, no one can think of that as efficient use of land. And anything we can do to decrease that is going to cut the cost of business and make land use and the cost of developing much cheaper in this town. So, you know, there are small costs here and there to make it a better place to walk, but those have tremendous benefits very soon.
Well, and I don't think I addressed the second issue of our economic impact analysis. So I talked about the value of property, but I missed pointing out that for most of the types of development that we studied, and the code brings the most changes to commercial property, industrial property, and multifamily. So it's going to have very little impact on like single family. So for the types of developments that we studied, for the most part, the costs will be the same or less than in the current code. There are a couple of types of developments, certain retail uses and certain restaurant uses, depending on, you know, their location and the situation, the cost there could rise a little bit. But for the most part, the costs of development, as we studied and modeled in our economic impact analysis, the cost will be the same or less under the provisionally adopted code.
Okay. Well, we've got about a minute, and I'm just going to invite each of you. What do you want to leave the audience with today? What should they be thinking about?
You know, I'd start, if, you know, looking at this, the rewrite has been called radical by someone. And in truth, it's not radical at all. It sets a very, very low bar for development in Anchorage. Almost everybody developing, building homes or commercial properties now easily step over that bar. So,
and I got to move to Erica.
I'm just excited that people are interested in this topic. And I feel grateful that we, you know, have a chance to get involved in forming the future of our community.
Well, that's great. We had a lot of participation. Thank you, everyone who called in and who are going to the website now to read things that they didn't know were there before. It's been a great hour. Thanks to my guests, Erica McConnell, planner with the Municipality of Anchorage, and John Weddleton, citizen planning participant and a small business owner. Coming up next week on Hometown Alaska, join host Charles Wolforth for discussion on September 11th as the 10th anniversary fast approaches. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Also, make sure to check out our new website, alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thank you.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.